This is a podcast from Minute Media.
Hey everybody, how's it going here at Keystone Comic Con? Good? Yeah? All right, Friday night. This is how we do it, Friday night talking about the X-Men. Very exciting. My name is Alex. I'm the host of Comic Book Club, a live talk show in New York that's every Tuesday. Very excited, though, to be in Philadelphia to talk to these two gentlemen, Rick Reliandi and Bob McLeod. Let's give them a big round of applause. This isn't X-Men related, but how's your con been so far? How are things going for you guys? How are you feeling?
Pleasantly surprised. Oh. It's doing very well. A lot of nice people coming up and either just talking or buying a sketch or whatever. It's been a good show so far for me.
Yeah. Rick, how about you?
The test for me is whether I do silly sketches. And so far, all the sketches have been on point. No sillies.
Excellent. I love it. Well, let's talk about the X-Men. Both of you came in on seminal points in the X-Men's run, various parts of the franchise. How did you get involved? What was your first view on it? What was your first thought when you started on X-Men day one, if you can remember?
Should I go first? You want to go first? I actually started because Jim Sherman, another artist, had started X-Men 151, and I don't know the reason why, but for whatever reason, he started laying out some pages and then left the book. I don't know if he got ill or had to leave town because of a book he was after him or what, I don't know. But they asked me to take over penciling that issue, and I had only penciled a few fill-in issues for Marvel up to that point, but I'd done a lot of inking, but penciling, I had only penciled an issue here or there as fill-in artist. So they wanted me to fill in on this issue of the X-Men. So I did. I took Jim's layouts and kept some of them, threw out some of them, changed a lot of it over to my style, and that was only a few of the pages, and then it kind of just did panels here and there, and then it disappeared. So I had to pretty much draw half the book myself, and then I inked the last two pages, actually. And they like what I did on that issue, so they invited me to do the next issue as well, X-Men 152. I don't know if any of you saw that issue. That's where Storm and the White Queen switch bodies. It's a very interesting storyline. And had a great time doing that. And again, they liked what I did on that issue. I think Dave Cockrum had just left the series, maybe, is why I was doing these fill-ins. They needed a new regular penciler. And they actually offered me the book. They said, would you like to stay on as regular penciler on the X-Men? And I said, yeah. That sounds good to me. And then they said, what? But also, we have this spinoff we're thinking of doing of a younger team of X-Men. And you could be co-creator on that book if you wanted to do that instead. And that ended up being the New Mutants. And I obviously chose that.
Well, what was, Rick, we'll get to you in a second, but I'm curious, what was it in particular that turned you towards the New Mutants, this raw idea versus the X-Men, which was a little more established?
Yeah, I really wanted to draw the X-Men. The X-Men was obviously the X-Men, and it's fun. It's a fun book to draw, always has been. So I was very excited to be considered for the X-Men. But then again, how often would I get offered a chance to be co-creator on a new series? And you got to remember, at the time, I didn't know if New Mutants was going to just go in the toilet, if it was going to totally fail. Nobody would care about it at all, or if it was going to be a big success. I didn't have a clue. And this was at the 1982, kind of at the beginnings of the fan market, and so there wasn't a lot of feedback from the fans right off the bat to give me any kind of idea of what I was getting myself into. But still, I mean, I just chose it for the fact that I could be co-creator.
Yeah, well, that worked out okay. Rick, what about you? What drew you to the X-Men initially?
So I was working away on Cloak and Dagger. I think it was the second iteration of Cloak and Dagger, which at that point was a bi-monthly book. But I was also going to school on the side without necessarily telling anybody that's what I was doing. So I was kind of chronically behind on schedule. And at some point, well, to be precise, about issue 5 or so, Carl Potts had enough of my stuff. So he kicked me off of Cloak and Dagger. And then the very next day, I got a phone call from Ann Nocenti to do X-Men 201.
So X-Men was your demotion for doing a bad job on Cloak and Dagger?
Something like that, yeah. Okay. I think that the actual senior team, John Romita, Chris Claremont, and all those guys had just, for issue 200, that was the excursion to France. So I think that whole team, in fact, had it all those real body guys had actually gone to France to do research, and they were still recovering. So 201 was an orphan book, really, kind of. Who knew that the baby that appears in issue 201 was going to be, you know, Cable later in life? So that book shows up getting autographed quite frequently now.
One of the other big contributions I think you put into the X-Men mythos was Genosha, the island of Genosha. When you're doing something like that as an artist, when you're tackling a whole society, where do you even start? Where does the germ of that come?
Well, that's another interesting thing that happened about, I don't know when it started, but it contacted me. It sort of swept over into my world about 86 or 87, which is when the Marvel decided to go to the 15-issue series, 15-issue per year, set up for X-Men. They were doubling up in the summer. So in the months, June, July, August, they had no choice but to rope in fill-ins. So yeah, the first I heard of Genosha and that whole idea that Chris Claremont was hatching was as a result of being dragged in to cover Mark Silvestri, who was otherwise engaged. To be honest with you, it wasn't that hard. I mean, all you had to do was, this is before Google, but luckily there was a library down the street, so you know, I marched off and read everything I could on South Africa. Jan Hofmeyr and all that stuff, and the apartheid regime. It was pretty easy just to lift it, pretty much verbatim.
By the way, we are going to get to your guys' questions in a little bit, so start thinking about those. When it comes time for that, I'll come out to you guys in the audience with this here microphone. But one of the most frequent debates in X-Men fandom that I'm curious to get your guys' take on is uniform costumes or non-uniform costumes. Which side do you fall on?
Well, that was a big issue with the New Mutants. Yeah. We had to decide whether they'd have individual costumes or school uniforms. With the X-Men, they were the new X-Men I'm talking about with Storm and Wolverine and all those, as opposed to the original X-Men. The new X-Men, I thought, were so varied that they worked better with individual costumes. The original X-Men with Iceman and the Angel and all those guys, they seem to be less of individual personalities to me at the time anyway. So I was cool with them having just regular X-Men, like uniforms, the black and yellow stuff.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that Chris kind of brought along was this whole idea of the X-Men as a squad, as an almost military squad. That they would, each one had each character in the X-Men, you know, contributed to the teamwork and the actual, you know, the attack, if you will. But each individual had his or her own MOS, her specialty. And I think if you look at the way that he dealt, that he wrote, especially the team-on-team action scenes, You could tell that he was thinking in terms of, well, this character works best at long ranges. This is the close-in character. This is your assault character, and this is your follow-up character. So, you know, there were definitely plays involved in the way he staged his fight scenes, and it only made sense, therefore, that per each character's specialty, there would be specialty costumes that would amplify and reinforce what that character was all about.
Was there or is there a costume in particular that you're drawn to and one that you just absolutely loathe drawing?
I love Storm's costume, the black and white costume, the Dave Cockrum design. She's one of the my characters that's my favorite to do for sketches at conventions. Because of her costume and her little head thing.
Yeah.
And the white hair is just very dramatic against the black costume, so it's great. I don't think I hate any of them.
Colossus, right? He's the worst with the stripes and everything.
Okay.
Yeah. Right? There you go.
Yeah. Well, Colossus is probably my least favorite to draw. Yeah.
Well, you know, in fact, though, if you the striations you're talking about the metal striations in his body,
yeah,
you could done properly. Those striations will help you model the form a lot. They actually turn the form. It's a drawing assist if you look at it that way.
Interesting. Let's go to you guys for your questions. Raise your hand. I'll come out to you. Ask anything for these folks, anything about their history with the X-Men, their time drawing the X-Men, anything like that. Does anybody have anything? Nobody? You, sir, right there. I'll come out to you. What is your name and what is your question?
My name is Sean. I was a big fan of the X-Men in the 80s. And just in terms of your relationship with the writers, which writers did you really enjoy drawing the work of and why?
The only writer I worked with was Chris Claremont. And Chris would give you very complete plots rather than full scripts, right? So the final dialogue wasn't necessarily there, but the story he would give you in plot form, and he always gave you way too much story to fit into a 20-page comic. So there was a lot of editing involved. You had to take out stuff because there just wasn't room to get it in the comic. And so I talked to Chris about that, and he said he was fine with me editing stuff out. He'd rather give me too much than too little. He didn't have a problem with it. Chris gave me a compliment, actually. He told me he was surprised because I started out as an inker and switched over to penciling, and he was surprised that I could do storytelling because most inkers didn't study visual storytelling and were weak in that area. So he was pleasantly surprised when we started working together. I always got along well with Chris, still do. You know, we still see each other a lot at conventions. I haven't worked with him too recently. I did a X-Men comic a couple years ago with him, X-Men Gold number one. He writes more than I would prefer. You know, puts more dialogue balloons in the panels than I would prefer. He likes to like sprinkle them around the panel, so there's a lot of little separate little balloons, which to me covers up too much of the art. You know, but he's obviously a very good writer. I enjoy his stories. I think he's got an incredible imagination. One thing that bothers me is he likes to place the balloons, and a lot of times he'll put them at the bottom of the panels. And I don't like balloons at the bottom of the panels. It's like a helium balloon that's lost its helium, you know? So I like the balloons up near the top of the panels, but he and I disagree on that. So,
Rick, what about you?
Well, I likewise, I've only worked, as far as the X-Men are concerned, and then the New Mutants as well, with Chris Claremont. So, yeah, he exactly right. I mean, he gives you full plots, but what he does do is he trusts you enough to give you the backstory, why things are happening. You will occasionally encounter writers who only tell you exactly what they think you need to know. It's, you know, character walks from left to right, character opens door, character. Not why they're doing it, you know, not what it's all about. Not you don't get any taste of motivation or anything like that. And a lot of that, you know, when you bump into writers like that, a lot of times they're motivated out of a kind of defensiveness. They don't want the penciler knowing too much so that the penciler starts to play and kibitz and interfere. So a lot of times we're treated like mushrooms. We're kept in the dark. And so Chris, by contrast, is very generous with all of the stuff that's bubbling in the back of his mind, and you have to kind of wade through it, but it gives you a deeper understanding of what's happening in terms of the characters and why the characters are doing what they're doing.
He actually feeds off what you give him.
Exactly. Yeah, so he's a real pleasure to work with. He makes you work, it's true. And I learned, I think I learned more working on Claremont plots about how to make panels do double duty and triple duty. It's like, yes, Storm is smacking this person in the head, but in the background, you'll see Wolverine also talking on the phone. You know, that kind of thing. He makes you work very efficiently and keeps you honest.
This is veering away from...
He paid a terrible price for it, but...
This is veering away from X-Men a little bit, but just because you're talking about the way that Chris Claremont writes very densely with the plot and everything, do you find you prefer that take on writing when you're going in and penciling something, or the Marvel style where it's just the rough outline of what's going to happen in the issue and you fill in the rest? What's your preference there?
Well, every writer at Marvel had their own version of the Marvel style. So there was a Stan Lee version where he would say, have Galactus fight the FF this issue, go to it. And that would be it. And then there's Chris Claremont, who gives you so much. And there's everybody was a little bit different. It wasn't like they all did the plots the same way. But as a penciler, I always preferred a plot over a full script because I could get more involved in it. I could be the director and instead of having just to draw a close-up when the writer wants me to draw a close-up. I could decide how many panels to put on a page or how to move the camera around and be an equal partner in the storytelling. Much more fun.
There's also, if you're working with a full script, at least this is speaking personally, when I work with somebody who's very directive, I tend to waste a lot of time thinking about all the ways that the guy is wrong. You know, I all the ways that this could be better or should be better and will be better once I, you know, jump in and, you know, take my prerogatives. But there's time lost in overcoming, you know, in kind of nursing your own ego versus the ego of the writer, and it's just wasted time. Better just to stand out of the way and let me do my thing.
Would you go against the writer on a full script?
Oh, yeah. All the time.
Can you think of an instance of that?
I've massaged an awful lot of plots. I'm not going to name names or anything like that.
It's fine. It's not getting out of here, other than the podcast we're recording. But otherwise, it won't go anywhere. It's all good. No, you don't need to name names.
I'm working on Batman Beyond right now, and there's this stuff that's happening, and I'm like, what? You have these kind of what moments, and you have to make the best of them. You have to find a way to make them work, and cool. Too much of it, and you start to suspect that the team is somehow seriously defective, but.
Let's go back to the crowd. This hand shoot up right here. What's your name? What's your question?
Hi, my name is Marcy. I was just curious, how do you go from being someone that draws in your room to drawing for Marvel?
You get the call one day, right?
Yeah,
you're in your room.
Yeah.
And then it just happens. No, I'm kidding.
I mean, That's a long story with me. We've got time, I guess. Since I was 5 years old, I decided I was going to be some kind of cartoonist. I had my mind made up. I was going to be an artist when I grew up. So it took me a while, but I went to art school. I went to college, majored in art, and I quit both of those because they weren't teaching cartooning. They were trying to teach you commercial art or fine art, and I wanted to be some kind of cartoonist. So finally, at age 24, I decided it was time to start my career. And I'm from Tampa, Florida. I moved up to New York because at the time, in 1974, you had to be in Manhattan to work in the business. But that's where the publishers were, and you had to go to them to get a job. So I sold my car to finance a trip to New York to start my career, to have money, you know, to finance this trip. And got rejected at Marvel, got rejected at DC. The art director at the time was Joe Orlando, and he actually told me I needed to go back to school and learn how to draw, which was quite a blow because, of course, growing up, your family and friends are always telling you how great you are, you know? So that was the first time I had seriously, I mean, I had some criticism in school, but even my teachers in school were telling me, you know, that I was doing very well. One teacher told me I did either the best design in class or the worst, because I didn't really get design at the time. But that when Joe Orlando told me that, I was, you know, confused because I knew I could draw. Why couldn't I draw the way he thought I needed to be drawing? So, yeah, well, what was the secret was I was all surface. I was just drawing the way every kid draws, just working on the surface and kind of doing an outline and everything. I wasn't building a structure for my figures in a three-dimensional way. So I had to, and he didn't, I mean, he did a little example for me, but I didn't really understand it. I just had to puzzle it out, looking at other artists, and slowly figure out how you do this. And it took me 5 years of really studying and doing sample pages and practicing before I got to where I was actually, I felt I was good at it, and other people were telling me that I was good at it. But I started actually, finally, after getting rejected and rejected and rejected, I met Neil Adams, who at the time was the top artist in the business in terms of respect. He was like this far above everybody else. And he just said, well, what do you want? He looked at my pathetic little samples and said, what do you want? And I said, just anything that pays. I was down to my last $10, going to call my parents to give me bus money to go back to Tampa. And I said, just anything that pays. And so he picked up the phone and got me a job in the production department at Marvel Comics doing lettering corrections. He said, I've got a guy here with some lettering potential, some art potential, but, you know, some good lettering potential. So I got a job in the production department doing lettering corrections and was taught how to do comic book lettering by the Marvel letterers, the ones that created all the logos for the comics. And my very first job was actually taping the page numbers onto the original art pages at Marvel. So I figure I started rock bottom and worked my way up. Lettering corrections, worked my way up to art corrections. And the great thing about being in the production department was I met all the editors, and I could show them my work every day. So I was just constantly getting feedback on my samples and eventually was able to go freelance about 6 months later as an inker.
Rick, what about you?
So I graduated. I always wanted to be a comic book guy. So it was either that or Disney type animation. So I got out of college and I put together. I wrote a story. It was a Spider-Man story, in which I actually killed Spider-Man, which is an idea that came back very much later. But I wrote it. I penciled it, I inked it. I put on my own word balloons, and this is back before Kinko's and all that kind of stuff. So, oh, I was 21, 2, something like that. Like I say, I just got out of college, and this is 1979. So, I did all these originals were on these enormous Bristol boards, you know, twice up size, the boards that you see on our tables upstairs. And at the time, there wasn't any, you know, like I say, no Kinko's, no way to quickly and easily blow those down to a more manageable size. So I used photomechanical transfer, which was state of the art at the time, to bring these enormous boards down to 8.5 by 11, which I thought was a nice mailable size for a submission to send off to New York, which is what I did. This was about November-ish of 1979 when the thing was finally done. Time went by without any response. ultimately, I got a thing back from D.C. with some vellum sheets over a few of the selected pages with some little pencil corrections or suggestions, and basically a note to the effect that I should try again. You know,
do you know who did those?
Probably Joe Orlando.
Yeah.
Probably, yeah. However, nothing from Marvel. And Marvel was the place I really wanted to land. DC was nice, but Marvel, come on. That's the bigs. So finally in January, so it's January of 1980, I go down. I finally just go down. I bang on the door. I get through reception. I goes, where are my submissions? If you're not going to hire me, that's great, but, you know, give me my stuff back. And it turns out that, as Shooter patiently explained to me, that I, in asking them to evaluate me as a penciler, I had not, in fact, sent them any pencils. I had sent them inked over pencils or pencils covered over by balloons or pencils that were way too small to read. And so, duh, you know, I'm not going to get hired as a penciler on the strength of a submission like that. However, the writing was weird enough that I might make it as a writer. And in consequence of that, he had shipped my submission off to Archie Goodwin. And Archie Goodwin, in contrast to Shooter at the time, was a very disorganized fellow, wonderful editor, but disorganized. So my submission had been lying on his desk for months. Without any response. So that was the story. What Shooter recommended I do is go home, do two or three sketchbook pages of just basic anatomy in pencil, please, and then come back. And that's what I did. So
like I said, they just kind of call you one day and it happens and that's it. Let's get more questions from you guys. Ooh, there's a hand from Hellboy right over here. Actual boy, Hellboy. What is your name? What's your question?
My name is Felix, and I was wondering, what's your favorite story that you've done?
Great question. What's your favorite story that you've done? And once you choose this, the rest of them cease to exist.
No, really?
So, sorry about that.
Well, I'm going to have to cheat and say that in terms of favorite jobs, in terms of inking, for example, things that I've penciled and favorite inked jobs is a New Mutants episode that Bill Sienkiewicz inked. Beautiful, just amazing stuff. So in terms of inking, that New Mutants, I think it's number 78 or something like that. In terms of concept, my favorite is the Watson and Holmes stuff. I mean, in terms of just an absolutely drop-dead great idea, why didn't anybody think of this sooner, Watson and Holmes.
Do you want to, for those in the audience who aren't familiar with it, do you want to just explain what the idea is?
Yeah, it's Watson and Holmes, only they're two dudes from Harlem. You know, that's just as simple as it gets. They're solving crimes, they're using all that deductive talent, but it's like, it's now, it's American, it's urban, whatever you want urban to stand for in this context. But great characters and great writing, and I wish we'd done more with it. Got an Eisner nom, so yay.
Yeah, there you go.
Carl Ballers.
That's right.
The original concept came from Brandon Perlow and a buddy of his, but they just said that. I guess they just sat down one day and said, you know what? Let's do Sherlock Holmes only. But I think they may have scared themselves in as much as they got into Sherlock Holmes and realized that that's an enormous franchise. That's a really well-established community and may, in fact, I would argue, is probably the biggest franchise in English literature in terms of breadth of exploitation across platforms. I mean, yes, you can do Robin Hood if you like, or King Arthur, but I think Sherlock Holmes supports so much of literature and has spun off so many descendants. If you dig hard enough, I mean, DC Comics, for crying out loud, what's the DC stand for? Come on, work with me.
How many people know what DC stands for anymore?
Who knows? Anybody?
All right, 10 people.
David Chase. There you go. Took me a little while, but I got there. Just real quick, before we get to your answer, I do want to mention that book, that Watson and Holmes book, is great, and you guys should definitely seek it out. It's a lot of fun. I don't know if you have any copies at your booth or anything like that. All right, well, comb the stacks here at Keystone Comic Con and check it out, because the book's a blast. What was your answer? What was your favorite thing that you did, Bob?
You know, it's a tougher question than you think, because you like different jobs for different reasons. So this might be your favorite for this reason. This is your favorite for that reason. This is your favorite for that reason. And as an artist, as opposed to a writer, to me, it's all about the art. So I couldn't even read comics that had art that I didn't like, no matter how good the story was. So the ones I worked on,
right with you, man.
Yeah, the ones I worked on. As far as fun to draw, that issue that I mentioned before, X-Men 152, where the White Queen and Storm switch bodies, was a lot of fun to draw. The New Mutants stuff that I worked on was harder. There was a lot of stuff going on there. I just look back on that as it was a harder job. When I was a kid, I read mostly Superman comics, and when I actually got to draw Superman for my job, it was kind of like an honor, because I had read it as a kid. And so I really enjoyed working on Superman comics, even though he, in a lot of people's opinion, isn't the coolest superhero around. A lot of people think he's old-fashioned and just hasn't kept up.
He's conservative.
Yeah.
By definition.
But I liked all the secondary characters. Superman was fine, but I've always just enjoyed drawing people. I originally wanted to be a caricaturist for Mad Magazine. It was my original goal. I was not that big into superhero comics. I'm still not. I mean, they're fun. I like them. But if I could draw whatever I wanted, it wouldn't be superheroes. I went to superheroes because that's where the work was. But I like drawing Lois Lane and Jimmy Olsen and Perry White and all the secondary characters. So I really enjoyed Superman. And there was, if I have to pick one story, there was a story where he went back in time to the dinosaurs. So I got to draw dinosaurs. So that was fun.
I'm curious, and we'll get back to your guys' questions in a second, talking about something like Superman versus something like X-Men, do you have a preference when you're hitting a solo book where it's going to be the same character page after page after page, or say something like the X-Men where sometimes there's 20, 30, an overwhelming number of characters in every issue?
I mean, a lot of artists don't like to draw group books because you got 8 characters to draw, and sometimes in this one panel instead of just Superman. To me, it never really was an issue with me when I was drawing the New Mutants or the X-Men. I was just solving problems. Where do I put this person? Where do I put this thing? How do I construct this panel? So if I just had one character, that just might mean I had to draw a lot more backgrounds. So it didn't make that much difference to me. I didn't ever have a preference.
Yeah, the hard part about team books is what I call elevator problems, is getting everybody off on the same floor. A lot of times, especially if you're not drawing their feet, the characters won't register. Like, this guy's too tall or this guy's too short. And it's like, oh my God, they're not on the same floor. But there's ways around that. And that's the sort of problem that you can encounter with, it doesn't have to be a team book. It'd be, Superman talking to Perry and Lois. I mean, you can have the same sorts of issues, but it's more pronounced in a team book.
Let's get some more questions from you guys. Does anybody have anything? Anything about... Oh, another one. I saw two questions here, so I'll come to... Not both at the same time, because that would be super confusing, but one of you at a time. What's your name? What's your question?
I'm Miriam, and my question is, when it comes to Gambit's character, will he ever take, a lead or a co-lead? Like, what's going on with him, and how did he get developed with his cards?
You need to get some writers up here.
Yeah. Well, have you guys ever tackled Gambit? Was that...
I've never drawn him.
Okay. Any Gambit takes?
I think he may have drifted through an X-Men issue of mine, but... again, as a cameo guy, Lee Weeks did a really neat, I think it was a run that was collected into a kind of a trade paperback, but this is ages ago. Really good work.
Your question, though, is what's going on with Gambit, just in general?
Right now,
he was just in a title called Mr. and Mrs. X that just ended. That was great, by Kelly Thompson. You should definitely check that out. That was he and Rogue suddenly, very surprisingly, got married. And it shows what happens as they go on their honeymoon. And, of course, they get hijacked in space. And then they come back, and the Thieves Guild attacks them and everything. It's a blast. It's also only 12 issues long, so it's easily readable. Definitely check that out. Mr. and Mrs. X. Yeah, there you go. I saw a question over here. Did you still have one? What's your name? What's your question?
Hi, Carter, longtime reader, first time caller. So I was torn between a more technical and a fun question. I guess I'll go with the fun question. I'm a sucker for when characters have a lot of variant costumes, a lot of different outfits and stuff. If there is one Marvel character you could have a pass on to sort of redesign their costume, who would it be?
Costumes are one of my biggest complaints about working in superhero costumes in comics. Whenever I have to draw a character I'm not familiar with and I want to look up what they're supposed to look like, every single piece of reference I find on them looks different. Even when it's by the same penciler, they're not consistent. They draw a bracelet on them one time and then not the next time, or it's on the right arm and it's on the left arm, and it's all different, and I'm too much of a perfectionist. I want them to look the same every time, and it's a really difficult issue. I mean, if it was me, I guess it started in the 90s, all these complicated costumes that looked great on a cover, but then when you had to draw them panel after panel after panel, and it's got little wires going this way and that way, and it's got pouches and buckles and chains and what have you. I mean, give me Superman's costume, right? So I would just simplify one of the more complex costumes if it was up to me.
Yeah, and the other thing about a lot of the costume design in that era was, you'll notice that the costumes were divided either by color or some sort of appurtenance, or a belt, or a bunch of pouches or something like that, along joints, like shoulder joints or hip joints. And that was specifically for merchandising. It was for making the toys. Those are the points of attachment and all that sort of stuff. So,
Since you're not seeing that sort of consistency, when you're tackling a new character, do you create a guidebook or style book for yourself or anything like that?
I make it consistent, yeah. So if anybody else is looking at my stuff for reference, it's going to be the same every time they see it. But I just wish everybody else would do that. Actually, a costume that occurred to me that I would like to redesign that I used to work on was Firestorm for DC. When I design costumes, when I like to work on characters, I want to be able to see the anatomy so that it helps me draw the character. So I design costumes that work with their muscles and their body parts so that it makes it easier and faster to draw the figure. Firestorm has these things that don't show his shoulders. He's got this mask on his head that doesn't show his skull. Just everything about his costume gave me fits when I was trying to draw Firestorm.
Well, the first sketch I was asked to draw today was Havoc, which you'd think would be really simple because it's just a guy in a black leotard. But then you start to play with those concentric circles, and it turned into a real nightmare. I freely confess, it was like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm still doing this. But yeah, so he's a guy. He's one of the guys. When he turns up on the sketch list, I'm like, oh my, please no.
Yeah. So when Joe Orlando told me I needed to go back to school and learn how to draw, when you have costumes, you don't just start drawing an outline of the costumes. What we do is basically draw a nude figure first, and put things onto that nude figure in certain places. So if it's a well-designed costume, that's easy to do. If it's a badly designed costume, God, it just drives you nuts.
Did you want to ask your technical question as well?
It's not too much trouble.
No, it's not troubling me at all.
I mean, I guess you guys kind of got into it, but in terms of when you're approaching drawing superheroes, what is the biggest technical challenge for you, just in terms of how to get that drawing finished?
It's a big topic. I'm going to answer your question by not really answering it, but to say instead that every character, done right, every character moves differently or stands differently, fights differently. Characters, pose, movement, fighting style, these are all elements, properly speaking, of characterization. So, I always go back to the example of Nightwing. Nightwing was, for my money, one of the most fruitful, or possibly fruitful, characters that DC possessed. I mean, still possesses it, but I don't know what they're doing with it. Simply because it was the former Dick Grayson, the wise guy, boy wonder, who had grown up, but he hadn't lost his wit. He hadn't lost his attitude and his edge. He could, you know, within the space of one book or one fight scene, he could go from being a total wise ass, you know, embarrassing his opponents, to being scary Dark Knight if he wanted to be, you know, as a grown up. And I thought, you know, there was enormous range in there for a character like that. And one of the ways you put that across was the way he fought, the kinds of things he would do in a fight, and the way he would stand, and the way he would, you know, the way he would pose and cock his head. So these are all elements you have to be conscious of and, you know, work to put in.
Yeah, the thing is, especially with the way I draw, I look at people as individuals. So I would never draw Superman flying the same way that I would draw Storm flying or some other flying character. Each character moves in their own way, hopefully, and makes them who they are. It's not a stereotype cookie-cutter thing where this is how superheroes move and this is how non-superheroes move. So basically I just think of them, who they are, and how would I expect them to move, and I just start thinking up poses that to me look like them.
Superman's actually kind of tough because there's not a lot of breadth in the way that he can move. He can't get into weird, awkward positions. He can't do a Spider-Man. It just wouldn't be him. So he's always standing there sort of statuesque. He's flying in a statuesque way. And it's, he's actually a surprisingly challenging character to take on.
I had a lot of fun drawing Superman because he was one of the first superheroes. And he's been drawn for decades before I ever got on the book. So when I got on, I wanted to do something different than every other artist had done with him, which we all want to do whenever we do a series. And so every time I would draw Superman flying, I would try to do it, at least in my mind, in a way that I hadn't seen him done before. Either the angle I was showing it from, or the pose I was putting him in, or how close up or far away, or just something about it, I was trying to be original. Which doesn't mean I was always successful at that, but I was trying to do that.
Interesting thematic sidelight to all that. Just something else to chew on. The fact that Superman is so staid and statuesque and stereotypical in the way he stands informs stuff he would get up to as Clark Kent. So in a way, you have to be conscious of that. One of the reasons Clark Kent is such a goof is precisely because he has to be so on all the time as Superman.
I know this is the X-Men panel, but we're already here, so let's just go with it. When you're tackling Superman versus Clark Kent, how do you change up the physicality but keep the character consistent?
Well, again, Superman is a superhero who moves in a certain way as a superhero, whereas Clark Kent is just an average guy to me. So I have him move the way I might move, where Superman does not move the way I might move. So it's two different people I'm drawing.
And of course, there's also the magic of comic books where no one can possibly tell that this guy is this guy, even though all he's doing
is taking his glasses off.
Yeah. More questions from you guys? Anything? Anybody? Ooh, there's a hand in the back right over there. We're going to come over to you. Ooh, you're going to come to me. I love it. Yeah, we'll meet each other halfway. I love it. Oh, this is a meet cute. Okay, what's your name? What's your question?
All right. Phoenix, thank you guys so much for being here at Keystone. My question is, do you have any good stories about the X-Mansion, and how many times have you destroyed the Danger Room?
Well, the Danger Room, in my experience, the Danger Room was Chris Claremont's, one of his go-to ways of explaining what everybody's characters were. I mean, that was him doing due diligence for the reader. Basically, he would stage something in the Danger Room, not because the Danger Room was cool or because we like fight scenes, but because you need to know who the characters were and what their powers are. And the Danger Room was the quick and dirtiest way of doing it.
What was the first part of that question?
Do you have any interesting stories about the X-Mansion?
Yeah.
Well, except that, again, I couldn't find a consistent reference on where this room was, where that was, how it was looked from the outside and everything. So I didn't particularly enjoy drawing the X-Mansion. The Danger Room, however, when I got on the New Mutants, I wanted them to stay in school much longer than Chris kept them in school. And I loved the scenes of the Danger Room and them doing stuff in the Danger Room because it's a Danger Room. It's not just a room like this. Anything can happen in that room. It can get really imaginative with it. So I always had fun with the Danger Room and wish I could have done more jobs on regarding that.
Yeah, when Chris eventually shoved off and went off to DC and started Sovereign 7. I don't know whether you're familiar with Sovereign 7 at all, but their headquarters was a bar. It was a bar on somewhere upstate on a creek with a, So I actually did him a three view of the bar, cutaway view, and a floor plan, and gave it to him. I said, here, let's do this. As long as we're doing this, let's
which is what we should always do.
Right.
I'm curious, just to stay on the New Mutants for a second, is there a character that you liked drawing in particular? I have to imagine there must be a certain joy in drawing Cannonball in particular, because you draw the top half of his body and then take a little bit of a break.
You don't realize how hard all that smoke is to draw.
Is it?
Yeah. I mean, if you do it well. Okay. Anything is hard to draw if you do it well. There's nothing that easy to draw in comics. The great thing about the New Mutants for me is I got to design them. You know, I drew them the way I wanted to draw them instead of the way someone else had designed them, and I had to draw them that way. So I had a great time with all of them. Designing him, my favorite to design was Cannonball, because I was able to give him big ears and make him look like a different superhero than had ever been before, just a normal guy who had these powers. And I actually got criticized for that in the Comics Journal. They said they were the ugliest team of superheroes they'd ever seen because they didn't look like Superman and Wonder Woman. And that was so deliberate. I wanted them to be just like any one of us who suddenly had these powers. So I had a great time designing all of them, but probably the most fun with Sam.
I got to say, not to add too much personally, but as a kid reading the book, that's why I was drawn to New Mutants, was seeing characters like Sam in particular who looked just normal. They looked like regular people.
It goes back to me wanting to draw for Mad Magazine.
Yeah. How so?
Well, because he's an individual character with, you know, odd things about his face. He's got a big nose and big ears. Instead of just your average stereotypical superhero face.
Cool. I think we have time for one, maybe two more questions. I see this hand over here from the guy in the awesome tie-dye shirt. Yes, you sure? Yes. Love the shirt. What's your name? What's your question?
So my name is Jim, and you guys kind of flirted with this a little bit, but I just wanted to ask you, you know, when it sounds like you guys really care about the art that you do and you really put yourselves into it. So, you know, have you ever really been sitting there and drawing a character and just been like putting yourself into it, your personality, your features, your whatever? And if so, like, what character is it? You know, what character are you that you've worked on in X-Men?
Great question.
I don't draw myself. I don't think I'm good at drawing myself, and when I, it's kind of like acting. When I am drawing these characters, I'm projecting myself into them, really. But I'm trying to be them rather than have them be me. So I don't really think of it in those terms. I don't think.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good answer. I think we're trying to bring them to life as much as possible for your benefit, which is why cosplayers should get more respect than they do, because they're in the same line of work. They're essentially vivifying the characters for your benefit. And I pointed this out to a cosplayer once and blew her mind. She was like,
Before we move on, I wanted to ask Rick, when you took over the New Mutants, drew them, so many artists had already been on that series before you. How did you approach drawing them?
Well, my recollection was that I think the way it read to me, I did that Sienkiewicz job that I mentioned, and I think I was using more traditional storytelling then. And then three other fill-ins I did, we were all gaga at the time over The Dark Knight, which had just come out. And everybody was looking at The Dark Knight. We all realized that Frank Miller was using a 16-panel grid, and he was knocking out interior lines depending on where the accents on the page were. So he could do four across, or he could do one across. He could do two across and big one, you know, this sort of thing. So I did at least two of those New Mutants with a 16-panel grid. And just structurally doing the architecture, I think, was occupied most of my time. The biggest thing about the New Mutants that I really enjoyed was that sense of family, that they were a family in a way that the X-Men really had ceased to be, that they had recovered a lot of that early family feel that the early X-Men had.
We only have a couple more minutes here, so I do want to ask you guys one last question before you wrap it up. One of the biggest things about the X-Men throughout the years is that it's a metaphor for something. You know, it's varied from year to year, from writer to writer, exactly what that metaphor is. But seeing as you guys have worked on the titles at various times, what do you see most in the X-Men? What do you take most away from it?
I mean, what I like about the X-Men is the diversity in the team. For so long, comics have been white people and the same kinds of white people. And so, and we even tried to take it a step further in Mutants, but the X-Men bring in Storm in and a Native American in and a Korean in and all these different nationalities and ethnicities. To me, it makes them more relatable to the general public. I've had people tell me, you know, they could see themselves for the first time in some of the New Mutants or the X-Men. So I think that it's a great thing that it's going that direction. I think comics are just starting to be as diversified as they should be, but it took them a long time.
Yeah, I mean the first was it? I can't remember which, in terms of the official score, which was the first graphic novel, first American graphic novel. Whether it was
Jim Starlin's
Death of whatever the character's name is. I can't remember.
Captain Marvel.
That guy.
Yeah.
God Loves, Man Kills, which was the Brian Anderson, Chris Claremont X-Men vehicle. But that was, I think, the clearest explication of that X-Men theme, that they are, yes, they are different. And, you know, it's up to the rest of us to figure out, you know, how we're going to assess that, and whether we're going to be prejudiced, and whether we're going to, you know, persecute and all that kind of stuff, or whether we're going to accept that difference. And you know, I still think that theme never gets old and never seems to be the necessity of having that theme reinforced to us never seems to go away. So to that extent, I think the X-Men are going to stay relevant forever.
Plugs before we go. If people are here at the con, where can they check you out? What's your booth number?
Where should they go?
B2?
D2.
Yeah.
Tuong 2. David Chase 2. That's what you need to remember.
Yeah, we're on the same aisle. I'm the other end of the aisle, D19.
All right, there you go. Check that out. Let's give them a big round of applause, everybody. And thank you guys so much for coming out. Enjoy the rest of your con.